Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
All right, welcome and thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to a special studio recording, and I'm your host today, Erin Fairbanks. We are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's Pizza, as always, in a beautiful sunny spot in the middle of Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we're delighted to have in studio with us today, Cecilia Kutcher, food healer. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, so we are going to talk mostly about pet food and feeding your pets. But before we jump in, I want to get a little bit of a sense of your background, because you've been looking at, you know, nutrition and food-based remedies for yourself and for humans as well as for animals for quite some time. So how did you kind of get interested in doing work in this field?
Well, it started way back when I was a kid. I guess the first thing that happened was a health food store opened in my neighborhood, and I grew up in a small town, and there wasn't a lot to do there, so it became like the place to go for lunch, and I wound up spending way too much time there, just looking at stuff, and I really liked the whole alternative medicine or like grandmother cure mentality, so that's where it started. And then I showed horses when I was a kid, and one of the barns that I rode with used a lot of alternative medicines and herbal remedies and things like that in order to keep the horses quiet or keep them calm, because you can't drug them. So that's how that really started with animals. And then from there, I got really lucky and was working with some of the old grooms, like really, really old school stuff. So like I could cure a splint on a horse's leg with a cabbage leaf, things like that. And so then it slowly evolved into dogs and cats because, you know, more people have dogs and cats than have horses. And it from there, it just kind of kept evolving and trying human methods and different modalities to see what would work with animals. And then at one point I got thyroid disease and my adrenal glands blew out. And all the doctors wanted me to go get irradiated. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's an intense process. I have a girlfriend who went through that.
It's really scary. And they grabbed my hand and said, you know, come with me, sweetie. And I was like, where are we going? And they're like, you're going to get zapped. And I was like, no, you're not doing this. And it was like, you're going to get cancer. You're going to die unless you do this. And I was like, give me some time. And at the time, I found a wonderful nutritionist who I worked with who got me into alternative stuff for people. And when I healed myself with his help, then it was kind of like, oh my God, this works for people too. And so from there, that's how I evolved to human beings. But really, my main focus is dogs, cats, and family pets.
Now, you know, this phrase alternative medicine is something that, you know, I hear a lot, but how do you define that for yourself and for your practice? Like, what are we talking about there?
What it means for me, I kind of hate the term because I think a lot of people immediately go to like extremes with it. What it means to me is not Western medicine. So it means that you don't need to get a prescription in most cases. It means stuff that grows on the planet. Very simple remedies. I mean, there's no antibiotics involved. There's no needles involved with me. Just things that you can commonly find, really.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, my father growing up was a chiropractor, and I always thought that was like a really normal profession until I went to college, and then everybody was like, oh man, your dad's like one of those crazy guys. I think there's like a real hesitancy if you haven't been exposed to, you know, non-traditional practices to really have a lot of fear or suspicion around those. And do you encounter that much in your work, and how do you kind of combat that?
I do. And it's kind of funny because a lot of times if I'm describing something to someone and they're kind of skeptical and they're not too sure, we'll take baby steps on it, because I don't believe in handing somebody 15 solutions and going, do all this, because you're going to do it for 2 days, get frustrated and say, I'm not doing this anymore. So what I'll do is I'll take two different approaches. One is if I'm doing like an herbal supplement, it's like this grows, this comes out of the ground, it's safe. So if it doesn't work, nothing's going to happen. So this is cool. Or I'll go the other extreme and it's like, okay, this is kind of like voodoo, like it's nuts, but it actually works. And I think nowadays, nowadays people are getting a little bit better when it comes to looking for different solutions besides what is at the drugstore or what comes out of the doctor's script, you know. So I think I'm lucky at this point because, and especially living in New York, I mean, people are much more open to it. But even compared to California, like, we're like Stone Age compared to what goes on out there.
Yeah, no, one of the things I think that makes us as Americans feel really comfortable with regards to healthcare is, you know, certification processes, mm-hmm. or education, or kind of knowing that the person we're entrusting, you know, our healthcare to has been vetted on some level. So you've undergone training through the Columbia University and the American Association of Drug List Practitioners. You know, can you tell us a little bit about what that training process and certification process looks like, and what, you know, what you're kind of have been certified for, and how that kind of?
Yeah, it's a roundabout thing, really. I mean, at this point, there is no animal nutrition course. So there are some that are being created by dog and cat food companies that I don't fully believe in. And so it's more of a propaganda thing for vets to, it's a marketing tool, really. And so what I did is I had all these years of training with all these old grooms and all these really old horse people and, you know, people that knew all this stuff from generations back. And you can't get any kind of certification or diploma from them, you know. So, like, I got all this great information that's dying out. And then I started studying herbology with the New York School of Iridology, which is Harvey and Judy Vetter, who are two of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And so I started working with them and just simple herb classes and things like that. And then kind of realized I needed to get a certification. So At the time, I enrolled in the Institute of Integrative Nutrition, which at that time was a classroom class or a classroom course, and spent, I think it was 2 years with them in order to become a certified holistic health counselor. So what that did for me was it strengthened up the ability to work with people, but it also gave me something with the animals. So in terms of, like, legally, I am not an animal nutritionist because that, it's a really iffy term. So it's kind of like the people that are using it, I'm not really sure how they got their certification. However, a lot of people call me that just because it's easier. But so what I basically did was I transferred a lot of my information from human nutrition and lots of experimentation and a lot of very simple stuff. I mean, if somebody comes to me with a pet that's really, really sick, I'll send them to someone else or send them to a doctor because that's what they need, you know. And one of the problems that I get is a lot of people don't do preventative medicine with their pets. So they'll show up and the animal will literally be riddled with cancer, had diabetes, and it's too late to do anything. So for me, it's better to start off in the beginning with the pet and slowly go. And it's about education, really. And so the certification I have is with the American Association of Drug List Practitioners. It's also at the Institute of Integrative Nutrition. It's also at Columbia University. And it's also at the New York School of Iridology and Herbology. So they're kind of, you know, woo-woo, but they all exist and they're all legit. So
cool. So now, you know, what should we, like, let's focus, I guess, maybe, like, picking dogs or cats or something that's, like, commonly found in a Brooklyn and New York City homes. And, when you have... Well, I'm just, like, all over the place here. I'm so excited to have you here.
Yay!
I want to know, like, what should people be feeding their pets? I think, you know, when you get a new dog and you bring it home, you know, you go to the grocery store, maybe as a starting point, you go to the pet store, maybe as a starting point. And for me, it's like picking out, you know, shampoo or deodorant. There's like 150 choices, and I'm like, it's a little bit overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And then I know kind of alternatively, you know, from working at farmers markets around the city, that there's a lot of folks who, you know, feed their animals a raw diet, or and there's kind of these controversies with regards to feeding from, like, the human supply chain, mm-hmm. versus a lot of pet food, I think, is a byproduct, essentially, of the human supply
Absolutely.
Chain. So I want to tuck into a little bit of, you know, where do we start with someone? Like, if I'm coming to you, a new pet owner, you know, what is your advice to me as someone with a fresh pup who's healthy?
Well, I think that, I mean, one of the simplest bits of advice that goes for people and pet food is if you see it advertised, don't buy it. So if you see a commercial of, like, some cute little doggy, like, running in a field and it's all sexy and, you know, his ears are waving in the wind and there's flowers and it's beautiful, the food's crap. Very, very simple. That's kind of how it works. Most supermarket brands aren't good either because they're mostly just fillers and they're mostly grains. Foods that existed, I don't really want to use names, but like foods that existed when I was a kid, and I'll just use Meow Mix because everybody knows it. When I was a kid, Meow Mix is not what Meow Mix is today. Same as, you know, Yodels or like junk food. It's very, very different. And so at this point today, supermarket brands are really just basically filler. And I worked at a vet's office for 4 years, and which was a great opportunity because it let me see and study really animals that were on subpar diets and see what happens to them. So in terms of dry food is like the most popular thing right now. Everybody loves it. It's really convenient. It never goes bad. You can buy a 10,000-pound bag and have it in a closet and all this. The fact of the matter is that the way that dogs and cats' digestive systems are, dry food isn't really ideal for them. What happens is their digestive system is enzymatic. It's not like ours. Like our stomach is basically a bathtub full of acid. So whatever we put in there is going to digest and it's going to break down. Their belly is actually more like a pizza oven. So it's enzymatic digestion. So what that means is if you throw a handful of crackers in a pizza oven and walk away, you come back an hour later, you've still got crackers. So they actually need to drink water in order to have a catalyst happen. And so to start digesting. And as we know, cats don't drink a lot of water, neither do dogs. They shouldn't drink tons. If they do, there's something up. So if they don't drink, the moisture will actually come out of their internal organs and their skin. So, because it has to digest. So what will happen is you'll see the normal byproducts from dry food diets are dandruff, shedding like crazy. Usually they're overweight. Their stool tends to be massive because of all the fillers in the food. And one of the problems that you get in anywhere where you have to pick up your animal's poo is that owners get really obsessed about the texture of the poo.
Right.
And I understand that because nobody wants to clean up this messy puddle and all that. But what happens is a lot of people will get stuck on a food thinking it's good because, well, my dog makes really good poo and it's easy to pick up.
Sure. You know?
So that makes it a little complicated. But a lot of the dry foods right now are also very, very high protein. Okay, a cow is approximately 22% protein. I don't trust things that are 40% protein, 35% protein. It's too high, and it doesn't make sense. Logically, it doesn't work for me. This is totally my theory, and I have nothing backing me up on this right now, but I truly, truly believe that if we continue feeding these super high proteins to dogs and cats, that it's only going to take about 20 years. It's going to be a couple generations of animals, but I really think we're going to start seeing kidney stones in dogs and cats. And we're already seeing a lot more urinary tract stones and bladder stones, and that comes from a whole bunch of different things, but a lot of it is food-based. So, I mean, you know, pet stores hate me because I'm not a big fan of dry food. I prefer canned food because it's wet. And most of them, yes, they are byproducts from a lot of rendering plants and things like that. So you need to get food that's expensive. You know, a dollar for 12-ounce can, it's garbage. And so that makes it tough, too. The raw diet I love, but only for certain animals. Because
okay.
Not everybody can do it. I had a Siamese cat client, in fact, who in the summer, no problem. Everything was great, thriving on it. In the winter, couldn't do it. It was too cold. And the proteins they were feeding the animals, there's heating and cooling proteins. So they were feeding cooling proteins because the cat liked turkey. Very simple. And what happened was the cat was freezing. And the cat decided, the cat was miserable, freezing, really skinny. And was like, I don't want to eat anymore. I'm freezing. So what I did with that one is we switched it over to a canned diet in the winter of warming foods, and everything was cooked, and the cat took to it and did beautifully. So I think that I like raw diets. It depends on the climate where you are. It depends on the history of your animal. It's kind of like us, you know? There is no number one perfect food for all of us, and so that's where it gets a little bit tricky. I love the raw companies. I think they're much more socially responsible for the most part. And I know most of them, and they're really, really good people, and they try really, really hard. Cooked foods, you can buy now cooked foods that are on the market that are cooked and frozen. It's convenient. It's kind of like a TV dinner, because once you cook it and you freeze it, you're losing more nutrients. So in theory, it's great, but it's also one of the big problems that we have as people is that we'll pick up a can or a bag of food and we'll read it, and it's obviously marketed towards us. So it's like, ooh, that sounds sexy. You know, it'll be like, oh, Grammy's pot pie or something like this. Like, oh, I'd like to eat Grammy's pot pie if I was a cat. That sounds lovely.
Right.
But you need to realize that, you know, one of the ideal diets for a cat is a mouse. And I have a friend whose favorite thing in the world, he does this as well. And people will ask him, what's the ideal food for a cat? And he'll say, mouse in a can. And he really wants to create this product, but there's no way this is going to come off, you know. And just open up a can and there's three dead mice and feed them to your kitty and yay!
You know? I that could make for some really awesome practical joking. I think we're gonna take just a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, sustainability with regards to the food supply chain and kind of continue talking about options for feeding our pets. So sit tight. We'll be right back.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day.
You're listening to Pumpkin Pie by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
All right, welcome back. You are listening to the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special studio recording. We are in the studio with Celia Kutcher, and we're talking pet food. Now, Celia, one of the things I think is so kind of interesting when we're looking at ideas of sustainability in the food supply, you know, more generally, is that you know, when you take the life of an animal, cow, chicken, pig, whatever it may be, that there's a lot of that animal that can go towards human consumption. But then there, you know, it's the blood and the bones and some of the innards that there's just not a huge market for. And a lot of that, I think, currently is being diverted to pet food or to other to animal feed in some form. And, you know, To my sense, it seems like a logical and or like useful, sustainable solution to make sure we're kind of maximizing all of the kind of usable product for those animals. But I don't know if you would have a different take on that, or if you don't feel like that is like an appropriate use for animal feed, or if there's some distinction between, you know, larger scale or smaller scale operations and you know what's happening in that arena.
I agree with you. I think that I am a firm believer that if an animal's going to be slaughtered, you should use the entire thing. One of the big misconceptions in pet food, and it's a marketing thing, is muscle meat. Oh my God, muscle meat. Yay, chicken breast in here. If you watch like nature films or like the old Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom kind of things, you'll see an animal in the wild slaughter something. And the first thing it does is it actually rips open the stomach. And it eats the contents of the stomach and the intestines first. And the only time the muscle meat really gets eaten is like when the jackals come in. You know, like that's its prime calories, but it's not as good as what is actually in the belly of the animal. And I think one of the problems that we have is this desire for breast meat and for, you know, prime, like not prime meat, but like the prime cuts.
We love breasts in the U.S.
Oh my
what
God,
is
we're
that?
So
the breast
with
of any animal.
Anything, doesn't matter. It's all good, you know? And so with animals, I'm all about organ meat is great. If you're making food for your pets, you can't use organ meat every day. However, the incorporation of organ meat, I think, is wonderful. What I don't like is when you start seeing things like bone meal Or like, you know, toenails, that kind of thing, that just there's no real use for it. It makes me really, really sad in our food industry of how much is slaughtered that is just completely wasted. Or like, you know, chicken coxcombs, you know, oh, this is what we have in our cat food. And it's like there's no pro. It's like eating a mole. You know, there's nothing in it that's really going to work for you. I like the smaller companies because I think they're much more socially responsible. I haven't found any yet that aren't tiny, like individual farmers and local farmers. I haven't found a company that's big yet that is able to slaughter and do everything from raising their pets on. But there are some incredibly fantastic farmers and companies and farms in New York, at least, that do have pet food, that do human food as well. And their stuff is fantastic. Like my cats, if I buy that, they go nuts. I mean, They're just like, oh my God, it's the best thing ever. They get all excited and it's really funny to see, but they can smell it from the second it comes in the house.
I'm wondering about, you know, cost. I know like as we look towards smaller production models, there's often an increase in price. If you're looking for a more traceable supply chain, there's usually an increase in price. And, you know, as a pet owner, like, you know, where does that responsibility lie in you and kind of, you know, financing your budget for your household? Should you not get a pet if you can't afford to feed them high quality food? I mean, is there a distinction that we should be drawing or pushing or, you know, striving towards?
I think that's a great question. I think, and I saw this in the vet a lot, where, you know, people fall in love with a pet and they pick one up wherever. And then they come in and they're like, what do you mean my bill's $500? And it's like, you know, animals are expensive. And the first year that you have a pet, I think it's the first year you have a dog, you're going to be spending approximately $4,000 in bills. And the first year you have a cats are a lot cheaper. I think it's $900. But so, I mean, pets are an investment. And I think people forget about that. I think it's great if you rescue an animal that's, you know, a shelter animal that's going to be put down and you can't afford to feed it top of the line, you've saved a life. So I think that's awesome. And I think that that needs to be really respected. A lot of times making your own food is really, really cost effective. However, if you live in a city like New York, everybody is super busy. I mean, we barely have time to cook for ourselves here. So to be like, oh, cook for yourself, cook for your kids, cook for your dog, yay! I mean, like, let's get real. It's not going to happen, you know? So I think what it comes down to really is, it's the same as people, in my theories anyway, that, like, you know, you can feed them top of the line every single day. Yes, it's going to cost you a fortune. But if you play a little bit, you know, and give them not the top of the line food. Don't feed the 99 cents for 10 pounds, but also you don't have to feed the, you know, $100 for 5 pounds. You can kind of go in between or shake it up. You know, some days feed top of the line, next days feed a little bit less. But the problem is if you go from like the garbage food to the top, you're going to get diarrhea. So you need to be a little bit consistent, you know, but it's, dogs and cats are an investment. Obviously, herbivore pets are a lot cheaper, like rabbits, gerbils, guinea pigs, that kind of thing. Cause they don't need the blood protein. People talk about vegetarianism in dogs and cats. There's no way possible a cat can be a vegetarian. I don't care. I'm sure there's an exception. However, I have never seen it. And in terms of dogs, I've seen vegetarian and vegan dogs. They don't thrive. So I don't. If you're idea of if you don't want to kill anything and you don't want to eat meat and all that, that's awesome. But animals like dogs and cats, they're carnivores and they need it. It's not a moral issue when they kill. So for people that don't want an animal to eat meat, then I think they should get an herbivore. Very simple. And it just takes, you know, a little bit of practice and a little bit of toying, but you can make it affordable. You just, and you don't have to feed, you know, filet mignon every day or anything.
Well, just like us, I'm not out eating filet. I go slumming, you know, I get my slice
totally.
Of the corner pizza, I'm not going to lie. On that kind of topic of city, you know, city versus country, do you find, you know, based on the lifestyle of the animal, whether you're in an urban environment or a rural environment, do their kind of calorie needs vary? Does the diet change much when your physical location is changed like that or not really?
It's changed pretty hugely. I mean, if you live in like the suburbs or the country and you have a cat, for example, they hunt. So usually they're really healthy no matter what you feed them because they're out getting mice and birds and snakes and all that. Calorie count, it really, really depends on how active you are. I mean, there's, without a question, there's a lot more obese animals in the city. Definitely. People don't understand the fact that, like, for example, like a husky, that race, the Iditarod, which is, you know, 1,000 miles or whatever it is, they've done tests on those dogs, and it turns out that at mile, I think 500 is right when they're starting to warm up. So, you know, to take your dog and walk around the block 3 times and throw him in a dog run for an hour, it looks great to us. But honestly, this dog is like, yo, I need about 30 more miles of this every single day. So I think in terms of obesity, and in the suburbs too, it's tough because, you know, you can't just let them out and hope they don't get hit by a car. So I think one of the problems that we have as a society with our pets is that we don't choose our pets wisely. We choose our dogs and cats by what they look like and not by what they need. And so usually the country and the suburb animals can eat a lower calorie diet because they're supplementing. But honestly, even in the city, we're feeding too much. You know, if you're following the label that tells you how much to feed, you need to keep in mind that these companies, their job is to sell this food. So they usually tell you about anywhere from a handful to a half a cup extra. So what I do, and one of the guides that I do is, like, for example, like wet food for a cat. If it's a small can, like a tuna-sized can, 99% of the cats out there do well with either a third a can per meal or a half a can per meal, and they're getting 2 meals a day. So it's really, you know, you need to watch your pets because an obese animal is much, much higher rates for diabetes and cancer and stuff like us, but it hits a lot quicker than humans as well. And treats are usually what everybody goes nuts with, and that's what makes them really fat. But I believe in treating. I like treating. I like treats. Why shouldn't we give our pets treats?
All things in moderation, right?
Yeah.
Well, Celia, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting. We'll have to have you back to kind of continue this conversation and maybe talk about some animals in the non-cat doc world. But in the meantime, if you want to find out more about her work, you can visit the website, www.foodhealer.com, or follow her on Twitter. It's @foodhealer. This, like all 30 of our live weekly programs, is available as a free download through iTunes. We're also on Stitcher Smart Radio. If you like what you hear, we hope you'll consider supporting us by becoming a member. Just click the Donate tab on our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org, and keep tuning in. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.